This program is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network, a world leader in talk radio since 1998. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Our Matrix server is about as free as internet chat can be. Join the existing rooms or create your own at chat.freetalklive.com.
This is Liberty at Night with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network, coming at you from Nashville, Tennessee. Kicking off hour number two. Let's talk about a couple things the government's doing that's wrong, that doesn't have to do with war, and us not making fun of someone like Robert Reich or whatever. This article from Reason, Charles, if you want to do this one. I think it'd be, I'd never heard of these guys before, but I'm going to look at it. JSX, they've actually got a seasonal flight like during the summer from Nashville to Destin.
Oh, that's cool. Since
I basically vacation there every other week during the summer, I think I'm going to look at that.
Yeah. It's a semi-private airline. You know, they got, I think, 30 seats. Everybody's
30 seats,
pretty comfortable leg room. And I think it's, you know, right around $1,000.
600.
From Nashville to Destin?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Oh, it's not bad at all. No. Airlines are asking the FAA
The
Federal Aviation Administration, to regulate competitor out of business. American Airlines, Southwest Airlines, and largest union of pilots want the government to change regulations that allow a smaller competitor to operate.
Now, the government would never try to regulate someone out of business because some of the bigger businesses in that industry are pressuring them to do so and pressuring them to write regulations that make it harder for competitors to compete against them.
Of course not.
The government has to have common sense regulations for the safety of the people, right? And it's never big businesses that are getting the government to regulate the smaller ones so they just become bigger businesses.
Yeah. That's never the big insurance companies writing the healthcare law.
No. Definitely doesn't happen.
A recent survey by the travel site Expedia found that 55% of Americans find commercial flight, quote, more daunting than filing taxes or visiting the dentist. I visited the dentist this morning.
Do you think that flying commercially is more daunting than the dentist or filing taxes?
Sometimes it can be.
You fly a lot.
I think once you get good at flying, then it's really not any more stressful.
By that,
than
you mean like paying for the lounges and the pre-check.
No,
and
like when you do it all the time
and all that stuff.
When you do it all the time and it's a routine.
Okay.
You know, you kind of things pop up and you're like, well, that makes sense. You know, it just doesn't stress you out anymore.
I do find it more daunting because I assume that I will die every time that I fly. And those are the only times I've been wrong my whole life so far that I can count. Right.
One smaller airline is thriving by giving customers a better experience at a price comparable to the major carriers. Naturally, the larger companies are petitioning the federal government to shut it down. Rather than big commercial jets flying out of major airports, the regional airline, JSX, flies smaller planes that look like private jets out of smaller private terminals. At the smaller terminals, passengers walk right out onto the tarmac to board the plane and don't have to go through TSA checkpoints. Wonderful.
That would be good.
It's amazing that they haven't found anything crazy on these planes.
I got straight up felt up on my last flight to Denver. I forgot to tell you about that.
Oh,
he kept warning me. He's like, I'm sorry, I just got to do it real quick. And he just kind of ran his finger
around the rim.
Really want to see the video.
Just the tip?
Yeah. It was weird.
Wow. Did he pull your hair after that? Did he take you into the back room?
No. Oh. No, didn't even give me his number.
In fact, JSX checks passengers against the TSA pre-check database ahead of time and brags that travelers can show up as little as 20 minutes before departure. This saves more than just time. Passengers on flights that require TSA checkpoints pay for them with a per-ticket fee. JSX fares run from $300 to $800, roughly equivalent to a commercial flight and cheaper than a first-class ticket. Now, I'm pretty sure that's one way.
You think?
Yes, because I've looked into this before.
Probably. They're probably giving one way.
They're one way.
More than likely.
JSX gets away with this by taking advantage of a loophole in FAA regulations. Flights with 30 or fewer passenger seats can be classified as public charters and therefore aren't subject to the same rules.
I don't like the idea of calling that a loophole. I know this is from Reason, but call it when the government doesn't do something to restrict you from operating. That's not a loophole.
It's called freedom.
That's just freedom. All the other stuff is tyranny. Mm-hmm. This is not a loophole. That's just freedom.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
The carrier won FAA approval to operate as a public charter in 2016. Its original fleet consisted of 37-seat passenger jets, from which it removed 7 seats, meeting the FAA maximum and giving passengers extra legroom. Ticket prices include drinks, snacks, Wi-Fi, and checked bags. Passengers are thrilled. Last year, JSX was the only regional airliner in the world to win a 5-star rating from the American Passenger Experience Association. Shut it down! Shut it down!
Just remember,
That's too much award.
These regulations are for the people. Mm-hmm. You know, you gotta make sure these companies don't get too big and take advantage of their customers.
And give too much of experience.
They're going to give them terrible service. Mm. You know, the seats are getting smaller and smaller, and you got no leg room. And now here's an airline right here where they rate it 5 stars, and they might just go ahead and regulate it out of business.
Yeah, they're too good. Yeah. They've been winning top honors for the 3rd year in a row. A Forbes contributor called JSX flights a new, simple, and wonderful solution to air travel woes. But not everybody is pleased. In May, American Airlines asked the DOT, the Department of Transportation, to provide regulatory clarity, charging that JSX's business model degrades our nation's aviation system and distorts competition.
What does that even mean?
Well, the whole entire aviation system as a whole in America has been degraded.
Like, there's a plane taking off from a smaller terminal, and it's got people in it, and they've never had a crash, and the people are happier than every other airline. And American Airlines says that this is degrading our nation's aviation system.
Yeah.
And it's distorting competition? What's distorting competition? Like, they wanted you to only have the 2 airlines? And now there's 3, which has distorted everything.
Yeah.
I know there's more than that.
Look, all American Airlines or Southwest has to do is just create your own version of this. Like, I don't understand why you couldn't just get some smaller planes, only put 30 seats in it, and then do the same thing.
There you go. They can compete against JSX.
Exactly. Southwest Airlines said that, quote, there needs to be one level of safety for anyone flying on a scheduled passenger carrier. Obviously, we've seen nothing in the news but JSX planes going down.
Falling out of the sky.
Over and over and over. Breaking in half.
I know.
Wings falling off.
You remember when like 30 of their planes hit the Twin Towers?
If you look up at the sky, you can see the passengers with their legs at the bottom of the plane trying to like make sure they keep the airspeed
like
going. Like the Flintstones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. These are Flintstones.
Or like they're riding the Batman ride at Six Flags.
These are Flintstone jets. Yeah. And it's hard to see in this picture. But because the wings aren't as steady, you can see the passengers have their arm out the window,
mm-hmm.
to keep that.
You stick it out and
that drag.
You move your hand up and down to
and
make your hand. Yeah.
And the crew is trained in how to help passengers row. Basically, it's air rowing.
Yeah.
But you just steady. You have to watch the video to get the full effect.
We can't tell. It's only the black passengers have to do the air rowing.
Yeah.
Down at the bottom of the
plane. Exactly, and they're in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to sit up front.
The back and the bottom. The bottom back of the plane.
Exactly. And it's hard to tell in this picture, too, but it's missing a couple wheels. And so when they go to land, they basically crash.
Parachutes come out and it drops slowly, nose down to the ground.
You're basically paying $600 to die in an airplane.
It's a wonder they stay in business.
It's a safety thing. Yeah.
So serious.
Yeah.
Such a serious issue.
Exactly. Look, the Airline Pilots Association, these unions,
care about people. This is the main problem, by the way. You asked, why don't the other airlines just compete with JSX?
Mm. Yeah.
The answer is they can't because of unions.
Mm.
That's why.
Well, the largest pilot union accused JSX of abusing a loophole that should be closed in the best interest of safety. It's all about your safety. It always will be about your safety. Mm-hmm. When we try to restrict other people, it's about safety. In August, the FFA, but that's Future mm-hmm. Farmers of America,
mm-hmm.
which is a fine organization, but it's not the FAA,
mm-mm.
which regulates air travel.
Completely different.
Well, they announced that it would consider changing the regulations that let JSX operate, declaring that it intends to initiate a rulemaking to address the safety risks. What safety risks are happening. Can anyone list one? List one. What? Has someone died on one of their flights?
I don't even know if anyone's gotten sucked out the window on one of their flights.
Like Southwest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many times have they crashed on the runway and ran off the end of it and caught fire?
Man. How many crashes has American Airlines had?
Too many.
Or United or Southwest?
Don't remind me.
The major carrier's complaints are not persuasive. American may claim that JSX distorts competition, but there's nothing stopping American or any other airline, that's what we talked about, from doing the same thing, offering short-hop flights on smaller planes that passengers can get to and from quickly. Yet the company prefers to complain that an upstart has found a way to eat into its market share without spending as much money as would be required to operate as a major carrier. And see, this is what big businesses do eventually. Like, they think it's unfair that these little guys are figuring out a way to try to eat at their market share. And rather than trying to compete, they want to use their power and influence because it's probably cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
Cheaper to lobby. Cheaper to lobby and to get your friends and buddies who are regulators, because they're all friends with each other. You know, you just call your buddy up, call Tom at the FAA.
Mm-hmm, I know Tom, yeah.
You're like, Tom, this is some bullshit,
mm-hmm.
You know? And Tom's like, well, we got a real safety issue here.
That's bad safety problems.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to talk about.
The thing is, it's easy for them to do the math, too, because they can look at, okay, how many flights does JSX have? Well, how much do they charge per ticket? Well, this is how much money JSX is making. That should all be going to us. And therefore, if we can make sure that JSX doesn't exist, all these people still need to fly. So therefore, they're going to be going to our airlines. And so here's how much money we would make if they are gone. So here's how much money we can spend lobbying Congress to try and get them to change the regulations on JSX.
Mm-hmm. Well, the pilots union doesn't like that JSX is exempted from regulations like the 1500-hour rule, which says pilots and co-pilots must have at least that many hours of flight experience before they can fly commercially. It's not commercial. This isn't a commercial plane.
It's not.
Plus, regulations on how much downtime a pilot must have between flights. But Gary Leff of George Mason University's Mercatus Center. Yeah, tomato, tomato, mm-hmm. Potato, potato. Center, that's a long center.
It is.
Points out that JSX has 30,000-hour captains mentoring sub-1,500-hour co-pilots. And since they are largely 1 and 2 hour flights, the company's pilots mostly sleep in their own beds, far better for fatigue than at nearly all major carriers. So the pilots get to go home.
Yeah.
To their own beds. To their families.
Short flight, like they've been driving for Uber all day.
Right.
Only it was a plane.
And the co-pilots may be sub-1,500 hours, but they're flying with, you know, with
30,000 hour captains.
They're flying with Captain Sully, basically.
Mm-hmm. Same thing.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So why are they mad about that? If you had a guy who was sub-1,500, wouldn't you want him flying with Sully?
The union is mad because these pilots aren't represented by the union, and therefore the union can't take money out of these pilots' paychecks.
Exactly.
That's why they're mad.
The CEO of JSX called the effort a brazen attempt to regulate JSX out of business, and said that JSX has a flawless safety record and far exceeds applicable safety, security, and regulatory standards. He also told the Dallas Morning News that not once in our 9-year operating history has anyone at the TSA, FAA, or DOT ever raised any concern with the way in which we operate. It wasn't until our competitors started complaining.
And now
they have to do a safety investigation.
Now the FAA has a problem with it. Now TSA has a problem. Now DOT has a problem with it.
All in an effort to protect you.
Mm-hmm. For your safety.
Yeah. You lowly passengers who wouldn't know a thing.
Let's move on to one more thing, like government waste. And then we're going to talk about old Mele, by the way.
Oh, okay.
We'll get out of here. The elections.
In Spanish?
No. The elections this weekend, on Sunday.
Hmm.
Mm. So we're going to see
fun.
What happens. The federal government spent $3.3 billion on office furniture as their employees were working from home. And so let's talk about a little government waste right fast.
This adds up.
According to a November 2022 survey, one-third of federal employees work entirely remotely, while 60% work a hybrid schedule, Most of the hybrid group go into the office one day per week and work remotely the other 4 days. So why then is the federal government still spending billions of dollars on office furniture? According to a new report by the government watchdog organization OpenTheBooks.com, the federal government has spent $3.3 billion on office furniture since the beginning of the COVID pandemic. The report found no material difference in the amount federal agencies collectively spent on office furniture between the years 2018 and 2022. In fact, the government spent considerably less in 2018 than in any of the subsequent 4 years.
Now, why is that?
Because they want their budgets. Because if you spend less, then your budget can go down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would think that in a time where people are working from home because of a pandemic, you'd be able to have a conversation with someone. Now, you could do this in a private business, but not at the government. You know, you don't spend the money, so therefore the budget goes down. Well, you got a human being there that looks and says, well, they didn't spend the money on office furniture in 2021, so therefore they don't need a budget for this. Or he could say, well, everyone was forced to work from home, but that's going to change in the future. So it does mean that eventually, someday in the future, they're going to need to buy office furniture again. And by the way, how much office furniture can you buy? I've been sitting in this chair for 7 years.
Yeah, that's because you have a tyrannical CEO who won't buy you new chairs.
Like how do you got? It's like the department.
It's not in the budget. Every time Nate comes to me, I'm just saying, I just always go, not in the budget.
It's like the Pentagon.
Isn't that like what I use?
Every single time. Yeah, I'm like, hey.
He's like, hey, Charlie, how are you doing? I said, not in the budget.
Mm-hmm. I want to say come on, sauce, but, you know, it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's just they don't need to buy new stuff every single year. It's like the Pentagon needing to spend $800 billion every single year. Like, you didn't have anything from last year. It takes a whole other $800 billion to do it. It takes a whole other $3 billion for office furniture. You bought such crappy stuff last year that it all just fell apart this year. You got to rebuy all of it again.
Mm-hmm.
I guess so.
You remember, it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, one of our first episodes, we covered how the Department of Veteran Affairs spent an exorbitant amount of money on this artwork and different things. And then turns out some of the artwork wasn't even purchased and the money went into this person's pocket.
Probably some of Hunter Biden's artwork.
And then that person was just placed on leave. They got to keep their job.
Mm. It's like sure, they got a letter in their file though.
Mm-hmm. Could you imagine just like taking $800,000 and then being like, you still have a job. Yeah.
If you work for the government, that's how it works. A July 2023 report by the Government Accountability Office surveyed the 24 federal agencies that occupy most of the federal government's buildings and found that 17 of the 24 use an estimated average 25% or less of their headquarters building's capacity in a 3-week sample period across January, February, and March of this year, 2023. They used
2023.
They only used a quarter or less of their building's capacity. In fact, none of the agencies surveyed, which included the DOD, Commerce, State, Justice, Homeland Security, and Treasury, among others, used more than half of their capacity in an average week. So they're all using either a half or less or a quarter or less. But the GAO report notes that none of the surveyed agencies have returned to pre-pandemic staffing levels and have instead embraced a hybrid model. The situation presents a cost-saving opportunity, according to the report, as the federal government retains more space than it needs. In one example, despite only using around 9% of its office space, OpenTheBooks.com found that the Department of Agriculture spent almost $57 million on furniture between 2020 and 2022.
For what?
They're only using 9% of their office space. The General Services Administration.
This is where those $1,200 coffee cups went.
Which manages federally owned buildings, including the purchase of office furniture, also uses only around 9% of its total office space. That is the GSA, which also manages the purchases of office furniture, only uses 9% of their space, but it spent $308 million on furniture.
That's almost a Powerball ticket.
The DOD spent $1.2 billion on furniture. Probably bought it all from Afghanistan.
That makes sense.
Although it only uses 23% of the space at its administrative headquarters in Alexandria, Virginia. Most federal headquarters are barely a quarter full on a given workday, and no major agency is at more than half capacity, OpenTheBooks founder said. Yet for some reason, we've bankrolled billions of dollars in desk chairs, couches, and more while employees clock in from their own living rooms.
Now, are they actually buying desks, chairs, couches, and more?
They're maybe. Or maybe there's some shell companies out there that sell furniture. I'd like to take a look at the furniture. Okay. Government furniture scandals are nothing new. In 2017, the Department of Housing and Urban Development spent over $31,000 on a dining room set for Secretary Ben Carson's office. The HUD Inspector General later reported that it did not find sufficient evidence to substantiate allegations of misconduct.
Of course. So the government investigated itself.
Yeah.
And was like, oh, we didn't see any evidence of any misconduct.
West Virginia House of Delegates impeached members of the state's Supreme Court of Appeals over lavish spending of state funds. The justices reportedly spent more than $3 million on furnishings and renovations as the struggling state made tens of millions of dollars in budget cuts. One justice in particular spent over $500,000, including $28,000 on rugs. Another spent $32,000 on a blue suede sectional sofa
that they got from Memphis.
Now that is that's a nice sofa.
Yeah.
I just bought like a pretty nice sofa, and it was way less than that.
Looks like that sofa from that Charlie Murphy had, that or Rick James had. No, Charlie Murphy. That was Eddie Murphy's.
This one probably repels stains, so when people like are
grinding, that was a blue suede couch.
The couch.
If you can picture it in your mind, it was blue suede.
I don't remember that. I can't confirm.
Your couch.
Can't confirm. All right. Okay, so government waste, Charlie.
Can you imagine spending $30,000 on a couch?
Of other people's money. How do you sleep at night? How do you feel okay doing that? This is money that was taken out of people's paychecks. And you're going to buy a $31,000 couch. And, of course, the Department of Defense is going to spend
$32,000
sectional sofa. And, of course, the DOD is going to spend $1.2 billion on furniture. They got an $880 billion budget, and they can't come under budget. Like they can't, because then someone would argue that they don't need $900 billion next year. Hmm. Okay? And so that's why they keep doing it. That's your money, folks.
This is the kind of stuff that just really makes me mad.
It's your money.
And like what we talked about yesterday, like at what point are we complicit? At what point do we say like enough is enough? You know?
This couch is going to push me over the edge.
Well, they
impeached that guy.
For the, for the American revolutionist, it was just a little bit of tea.
Yeah, I mean, they spent more on office furniture than all of the taxation they were mad about back in that time.
Yeah.
Even inflation adjusted, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Hmm.
But we just keep letting it go on.
And all the while, we don't have any money. And our cost of living just keeps going up.
All right. It's almost time for Dumb Belief of the Week, everyone's favorite segment on Liberty at Night with Nate and Charlie.
Are you a business owner? Are you confused by the complexity of the tax laws? We can help. I'm Dan Pilla, and I've been helping business owners solve tax problems for over 40 years. My book, The Small Business Tax Guide, shows proven ways to avoid all the common business tax problems. Don't risk your business. Go to danpilla.com to order your copy. That's danpilla.com. Order now and get a free 15-minute call directly with me, a $99 value. Go to danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com.
Who listens to radio at night? EMTs, truck drivers, law enforcement, and many other hardworking people just like you, buying products and services from companies just like yours. Many companies owe their success to radio. It's the engaging medium. Call 877-996-4327 or email advertise@gcnlive.com. That's advertise@gcnlive.com.
USA News Update. Israel has claimed responsibility for an airstrike that targeted a Hamas leader. According to the Gaza Interior Ministry, the strike hit a refugee camp in Gaza. The ministry reported that 6 bombs were dropped on a residential area during the attack. Evacuation orders remain in effect for thousands of people today after the Highland Fire in Southern California doubled in size overnight. Maggie Klein De La Rosa and Cal Fire in Riverside County says air and ground units are on the scene.
This morning early, the fire went a little bit further on the south side, moving west, which did create more evacuation warnings and orders.
The now 2,200-acre wildfire in Owanga has forced approximately 4,000 people to evacuate their homes. The blaze, which started early Monday afternoon, has destroyed three structures and damaged six others. Dave Collins, USA News.
Let me tell you a story about Bill. Bill was a normal guy in his 50s. He had back surgery about 2 years ago. Bill was in a lot of pain. He dealt with his pain by taking the Percocets his doctor prescribed for him. Bill took more and more and more of them to help with the pain, until one day the prescriptions weren't enough to get rid of Bill's pain. Then one day Bill found someone to help him get rid of the pain with illegal drugs he didn't need a prescription for. Fast forward to today. Bill lost his job and his family. The only thing he does have is his drug dealer. If you know Bill's story and you don't want to end up like Bill, call the Detox and Treatment Helpline right now to get away and get treatment.
800-296-1327. 800-296-1327. 800-296-1327. Call right now. Help is standing by. 800-296-1327.
Did you receive a call or message that mentioned Social Security and demanded immediate action? Did the caller know your Social Security number or other personal information and tell you that your Social Security number had been used in connection with the crime? Did you feel worried that your Social Security number might be suspended, your bank account might be frozen or seized, or you could be arrested? That is not the Social Security Administration. Social Security will not threaten you, demand your personal information or instant payment, email or text you pictures or documents, or use a real government official's name to gain your trust. Social Security does not accept payments by gift card, prepaid debit card, internet currency, or by mailing cash. Criminals use these forms of payment because they are hard to trace. Do not be fooled. Hang up. Ignore them. Report this criminal activity to the Social Security Administration Office of the Inspector General at oig.ssa.gov.
We still do email. Drop your email address in the entry box at freetalklive.com, and you'll be kept in the loop with Free Talk Live.
What's up? This is Liberty Unite with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network, coming at you from Nashville, Tennessee. Make sure you find our daily podcast, Good Morning Liberty, on your favorite podcast app, or go to BernieLies.com. Charlie's not here for this current segment, but I am sitting down with Young Voices contributor Eric Suarez. You've got this piece out. AOC was on Face the Nation, and she was talking about the sanctions in Venezuela. As a libertarian podcast, we've spent quite a bit of time talking about Venezuela in the past, and you have a connection to Venezuela. Do you want to let everyone know what that is?
Yes. Well, I was born in Venezuela. I was born in Caracas, 1999. You can say I'm the first generation that actually experienced Hugo Chavez. When I was born, he was already 3 months in power. So I grew up watching the country collapse, watching the socialist policies being enacted and destroying not only my country economically, but also politically, and the society itself just collapsed down. That made me have to leave. I left Venezuela when I was 13, almost 14 years old, and I went to Peru, where I had to finish the studies, and then I came here.
And so how long have you been in the U.S.?
Already 5 years.
5 years.
5 long years, yeah. I came here as a student, so I saw a lot of things in college that you will think, as a foreigner, you will not expect until you leave them.
What kinds of things are you talking about?
Well, there's a lot of radicalism in U.S. colleges. I think that people sometimes don't really believe it that much, don't think that it is as bad as it is, but it really is. And I will even say it's worse than sometimes it is openly viewed in social media or somewhere else, because I guess they show you the more peaceful radicalism, if you want to call it like that. But having lived it, having seen and having even talked with some of the people on colleges, the references that they have are very, very dangerous for a peaceful society or a society itself. So,
does it concern you coming here and then seeing some of that on the college campuses that the U.S.
might be headed in the wrong direction, the direction that you left your home country to get away from?
It really does. It always is a very shocking experience, because you always think, well, it cannot get worse. Sometimes it does, and I feel like, well, kind of linking it with what we have been seeing in the last few weeks with the whole Israel-Palestine conflict, I mean Israel-Hamas conflict, we have seen a lot of violence, a lot of very terrible justifications and moral relativism in schools that just tells you, well, this is very dangerous. To what extent the radicalism can justify what just happened in Israel. So there's a lot, and it doesn't stop there. I feel like it can get more dangerous than that.
So you said that you saw Venezuela collapse. Now, do you remember, you were pretty young at the time, do you remember the prosperous times and then when it started to change, or was that when you were a lot younger?
I guess you could say that the collapse, the real economic collapse, started a few years before I left. That's when the oil prices started to collapse, and you start seeing a lot of bread lines to get food. You start seeing that the supermarket shelves are getting emptier. There's no food. Nobody can. Inflation starts rising to incredible terms. So that's one of the reasons that we left. Before that, you could see the country collapsing in other ways. You would see that the society itself was getting very violent. The society itself was getting very repressive. You could see the government increasingly censoring, increasingly persecuting, increasingly doing all these things that now we know just led us to be in a dictatorship. I guess I lived through and I remember most is that transition process.
Just trying to look from an American perspective and a libertarian perspective, we blame the government and their policies. Is that the feeling among the a lot of the people there too, that it was bad policies, or is it that these evil, greedy businesses left the country, and or that the evil American regime putting sanctions on the country, and that's what happened, or does everyone kind of understand what policies led to this happening?
I would say that let's say 80%, 70%. Well, people do blame the government and the socialist government of Maduro and Hugo Chavez. Problem is that there is still this 30% that may not be well aware of how it was the policies and not the people. So there's a lot of people who hate Maduro. I will say that number goes up to 90% of the country, even 95. But they still see Hugo Chavez as a reference. When Chavez was here, it wasn't this bad.
All right. I just wanted to lay that out before we play this AOC clip that you had an article responding to, and she's on Face the Nation. She's talking about the sanctions in Venezuela. I want to play that clip for everyone so they know what we are talking about here. Let me pull that up. And we'll play that so people can hear it.
But additionally, I think we also need to examine the root of this problem, because if we are constantly engaging in foreign policy that drives people to our southern border, in this specific instance, U.S. sanctions that were originally authored by Marco Rubio began and precipitated, certainly took a large part in the driving of populations to our southern border. Shortly after those sanctions, those broad-based sanctions.
You're talking about Venezuela.
Yes. Shortly after those broad-based sanctions were enacted, we started seeing dramatic increases in these populations that were coming to our southern border. And so we have to address the root of these population movements and the migration crisis.
Do you think that these sanctions are the root cause of the problems in Venezuela?
No, she couldn't be more wrong about that. I think that at this point, well, we also have to know the context of when this was happening, right? Because she starts giving these interviews as soon as New York is being overwhelmed by a wave of migrants, and most of them being Venezuelan. And when Mayor Eric Abrams, I think, I forgot his last name, when the mayor of New York starts coming out and saying, we cannot keep holding this because this has become a real crisis for the city. I think with that context and knowing that AOC has always been a person or a politician that has promoted these open borders, everybody should be coming in kind of policy, is backfiring on her. So she's trying to wash her hands out of the situation of any responsibility and just saying, well, the root cause of this problem is not my fault. It is that Marco Rubio put sanctions on Venezuela, and that's why they're leaving, which cannot be further from the truth.
Venezuela collapsed before these sanctions were put in place, right?
Correct. If you want to divide the kind of sanctions that there are in Venezuela, there's two kinds. You can say that they are the oil industry sanctions, which are imposed on PDVSA, which is the national-owned oil producer. Then you have the personal sanctions, which are sanctions that are directed to certain individuals, which actually those started during the Obama administration, which she doesn't mention either. But those sanctions are basically directed towards people who have been accused or proven to be members of the regime that have acted against democracy or in human rights violations. So those sanctions are for them not to be able to get their money and spend it in the U.S. and be part or travel to the U.S. and all of those things, or invest in the U.S., etc. And then you have the oil sanctions that came during the Trump administration, actually well after 2016. But the timeline doesn't add up, because if you see the Venezuelan collapse, you see that it all started in 2013. You see, the breadlines are in 2014, up until 2017, we have seen this economic collapse that has been obvious for many years, that it all started way before the first oil-imposed sanctions started. And then she just comes and says that the mass migration started as soon as we get these sanctions imposed. Well, I will disagree, because when the sanctions were imposed, the mass migration did not start. I will say that mass migration started after around 2018, 19, and it was due to other political reasons inside the country. So you have to understand about Venezuela that up until 2020, there was still a lot of hope in the country that there could be a change of regime. And there was still a lot of people who believed in that change. That's why we see massive protests in 2014, 2017, 2019, and then we see the rising of former President Juan Guaido, which was internationally recognized, and he got a very big movement behind. And up until then, there was still a lot of hope. It was when that hope collapsed that you start seeing a lot of mass migration that started first within South America. So you saw a lot of Venezuelans going to Colombia, Peru, Chile, Argentina. And then it is when Biden comes into the U.S. and starts getting more relaxed on border policies that a lot of that migration and that influx starts going to the U.S.
Just to ask a question on her behalf, do the sanctions play any role right now? Is there an idea that if we didn't have the sanctions, then Venezuela would have bounced back by now and everyone would be doing great?
That's what she probably believes, or that's what she wants us to believe, or her audience to believe, but I think it couldn't be more wrong. I think that the sanctions actually benefited Venezuelan people in a lot of ways, because there's actually I use this story of things that happened during the sanctions, and it is that a lot of the business in Venezuela was oil. So the main source of revenue for Venezuela, let's say the socialist oligarchs, was through oil and dealings that was through oil. When that revenue gets blocked, it's not like, oh, well, we're just going to lose all our money now. No, they have to find other ways to get revenue through, you know, the government and government contracts and things like that. So they start investing in other things. So it's actually very interesting how you start seeing more businesses in Venezuela, like to launder money. You start seeing a lot of more food businesses as well, and that actually had a counter effect into the society. Even though the people were still being oppressed and there's still a lot of persecution and things like that, you saw that the regime's need to keep laundering money and to keep earning revenue forced them to look for alternative sources of revenue. So I feel like that's one of the reasons why this is very wrong. And the second is that the Venezuelan currency, due to inflation, was completely destroyed. Something very similar to what we're seeing right now in Argentina. What happened is that for a while now, the Venezuelan people have been using U.S. dollars to exchange and to participate in their market. So everything is dollarized, everything. is unofficially dollarized. The country is unofficially dollarized. So that also had a positive effect on the economy and on the people's lives. So I do believe while AOC and the squad and all these people, and all of these members, they want you to believe that it is due to the, let's say, the sanctions that the country collapsed. There's no evidence of that. It will actually be the opposite. You can make an opposite statement against that. And I do believe that the people who have been the most damaged for the sanction has been the regime itself, because you have cut a large sum of revenue that they had, that they did not have access for the longest time. And well, that revenue was used for a lot of bad things, like human rights violations, like financing the military, like financing, all of that revenue did not go to the people that they claimed that they were helping, or the social programs, because they weren't benefiting at all. It came for Russian military instruments, or financing their own military, financing the torture centers that there are still in Venezuela today. That's why I've been always a big pro-sanctions advocate on Venezuela specifically, because I know that these things are happening, and I know they're being funded by this revenue, and I think that should stop.
And so then when it comes to the mass migration from Venezuela, it looks more like this is a correlation, not being causation issue. The timing is more coincidental with what you were saying, people losing hope, things getting worse, and then deciding that it's actually just time to give up hope and leave. And that happens to be coinciding with us also having some of these broad-based sanctions, as she calls them. Now, when it comes to the migration from Venezuela, the immigration into the U.S., what are your feelings on how the U.S. is handling our immigration right now? Is the southern border too open? Do we need to be closing that? Should it be easier? Like, what are your thoughts on how we handle this?
I think it's terrible, and it has been terrible even before Biden. But I think Biden just made everything even worse. Look, I'm a big pro-immigration advocate. I believe that immigration is good. I believe that immigration, it is net positive for any nation that does it. But I also believe that it has to be done the correct way. We cannot just be letting anybody in without knowing who they are, where they're coming from, things like that, because there's a need of security, especially when you have a country as big as the U.S. and as involved internationally as the U.S. is, and as hated as the U.S. is by many other countries. So with that context, we need to have a strong security to know who we're letting in. At the same time, we should be making it easier for the right people to get in. I think that the Biden administration has been doing the opposite. I think that if you come here legally or the right way, it's actually harder for you to get your documentation and to get inside the country and to be legal than if you come through the border. I think that there has been a lot of wrong incentives. I like thinking about incentives. I think that the wrong incentives are being given out right now, and that's why we're seeing a huge increase in the border crossings. And then you also have other issues like gangs that work throughout the Mexican border, you know, drug trafficking that is also making a huge thing in the U.S. It's causing a lot of deaths and things like that. So and I do believe that, you know, immigration needs to happen, but it needs to happen the right way, and we need to protect the border and get more incentives for people to come the legal way.
Yeah, the government's typically pretty bad at making things easy and simple for people to do. They're not great at that. Was it difficult for you? Did you come here on a student visa? Is that since you went to, what was it? Was it Penn State, I think, that you went?
Yes, Penn State. It was relatively easy, yes. As a student, it was easy. It is a little harder to stay, I guess, after your time as a student is done. That's the challenge. Some people get it through jobs. They get a working visa. That's easier, but some people need to apply for other kinds of visas as well. I think that when you have, well, I've been lucky to have a really good education back home as well, and that makes it easier for people like me to come legally. Still, there is a lot of people who don't have the same benefits as I have, and that are still really good, hardworking people that should have a chance. That's why I've always been very pro-immigration. The problem is that now what I'm seeing is that when you don't have a control about these, you know, issues, I've seen a lot of, let's say, criminals come through the border. And I'm not trying to, like, be anything with these words. It's just that I've seen mass migration happen when I was in Peru. And at the beginning, there was very good people coming in. And then now you see Peru that is being overwhelmed by gangs and very dangerous people that used to operate in Venezuela that now are operating all over the region. So that also brings another issue that happens when you don't have your borders to protect. And I think that's also a negative for the Venezuelan people in those countries, in the U.S., in Peru, in many of these countries, because it gives a bad image. And that changes public opinion about who you are and about all these things. And that brings a negative.
It sounds like we're probably pretty similar on immigration. I just want a system where we can run everyone's name through that country's database. I just want to make sure that they're not on the run for something that's also a crime in the United States, especially if it's a violent crime. And
right.
The government's not, you know, if someone murdered their family and they're on the run and they're trying to come through, I think it's a decent idea that we check and make sure that the government's not looking for them for murder or for any type of other assault, something violent, something where you hurt someone. I'm not talking about they skipped on paying their taxes or something, whatever. But, you know,
right.
I don't care much about that one. But, you know, something, a violent crime where someone was injured, I would like to know about that. And other than that, it shouldn't be that hard to put someone's name in the U.S. database and print them a passport and let them come into the country after that, issue a Social Security number or whatever it is. But all right, I was going to ask. Are you a citizen or planning on getting your citizenship, or have you?
I'm here on TPS.
Okay.
My protection status. It's this. I don't know if you know a lot about that, but it's basically a protection service that a status. I'm sorry that people from countries who are in difficult situations get as a protection as for them to stay here. That was first enacted by President Biden. As soon as he got into presidency, he has just kept going. I think the latest update that they do. So basically, if you come here to the U.S. and haven't left the country before a specific date, and you are not under, you haven't committed any crimes and things like that, you can get that benefit. And then, that's basically it. And then you get that benefit, and it gets renewed every year. It's not something that is like a law. It's not permanent. It's just you basically depend on the president or the USCIS willingness to keep considering your country part of the list of countries that receive this benefit. So it's basically a limbo. You never know when that's going to stop. I feel like, you know, instead of trying to, and I think I mentioned this in the article as well, my main criticism of AOC is that she wants to solve Venezuelan issues, but it's trying to like actually benefit the Venezuelan regime. And there's other people who are actually trying to solve the Venezuelan issue here and abroad, and they're not getting half the view time that they would really deserve or need for them to make those changes. And one of them I mentioned in the article is Maria Elvira Salazar, who I believe is a good job on that sense.
But I was just thinking about that limbo process that you're in. Like, are you worried that you're going to wake up one day and that's just going to be gone, and they're going to say that you have to leave? Like, is that just a constant fear, or are you okay with
that?
Or?
Well, I'm not okay with that. It is a fear because, as I said, it depends on the willingness of USCIS and President Biden or whoever is next. You're not safe at all. It's not something guaranteed. So I'm not okay with that. I'm actually a bit advocate for Congress or something to solve this issue, because if one day all the amount of Venezuelans that are here just, I don't know, we become not eligible to work, because without that, you're not eligible to work. You get a deportation notice and all of these things. It's going to create a chaos. And I just don't think that's going to be any positive for the country as well, especially right now.
Well, that's so, one thing, if we could just spend a couple minutes on it and then we got to go. But one thing I've been advocating for is in the U.S., you typically would look at Democrats as people who are more pro-immigration, more giving people citizenship or amnesty or whatever it is you want to call it, and Republicans would be, you know, you'd see them as more on the side as wanting to deport everyone, less immigration. My feeling has been, I actually think that the people would land more on the conservative political spectrum, conservative to libertarian, given the countries that they've migrated from. But the fear that you're talking about, in my opinion, would give people more of an incentive to support the political party that they think is going to help them stay in the United States. I actually think that if Republicans would flip on this and be more willing to say, like, yeah, everyone who's here, we want, these are good people, we want everyone to stay here, let's find a way for these people to stay here, they would just win all the elections in a landslide afterwards if we just made everyone citizens and everyone had the right to vote and we said, no, don't worry about it, we're not going to send you back to you, back to your country, you're Americans. Am I way off base on that?
I've had similar thoughts about that in the past, and you know, sometimes I get very hopeful, sometimes I get a little less hopeful about that being a possibility, but I do believe that immigration is a huge issue, especially among Latino voters. And Latino voters are a growing community, especially here in the U.S. And I think that Republicans, they've already been gaining some ground there, but if they want to completely get that, you know, settle, the immigration is a very big issue. But what comes with it? You also need, I feel like there needs to be a concession, right? Because you cannot have immigration, yeah, let's make it happen, but no border security. That's mm-hmm. that's what removes a lot of people out.
You have to get both at the same time. You have to say, we're going to do this, and we are going to, let's just say, build a wall, or we're going to have full border security, and we're going to have, you know, you would have to agree on both of those things at the same time, because if you get one without the other, if you say, well, everyone's going to be a citizen, no one's going to be worried about going back home, well, then you have the biggest flood at the border that you've ever seen. And so you would need to get both of those at the same time, which is very difficult for the government to do.
Exactly. And that's what makes it the challenge. And I don't see nobody really pursuing that track. But yeah, sadly, that's the state of right now. But, you know, you're gonna lose hope. You have to keep arguing for it to happen. But mm-hmm. I think that at the end of the day, if we really want to tackle it, we have to stop pushing the AOC's narrative that it's because of the sanctions.
Well, that's how we actually understand what happened. The key is to understand why Venezuela actually collapsed and how to make sure that we don't do the same thing here, that other countries around the world don't do the same thing. We don't have a time machine, so we can't fix why Venezuela collapsed, but we can learn why it happened to make sure that we don't do it again. And then you can actually identify the problems and what needs fixed for Venezuela. Coming up, we got Dumb Bleep of the Week. Who said the dumbest thing? The live group is going to decide.
It's obvious. The unthinkable is happening. With all the recent media distractions, most folks never saw it coming. But a few did. Their guts told them something very wrong was going on. And now the headlines are proving them right. The people in charge keep telling you that everything's fine and to stop noticing. But you know better. Folks are investing in emergency food storage, and you should too. My Patriot Supply, the nation's largest emergency preparedness company, are the ones you can trust. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure their best-selling 3-month emergency food kits. Each contains tasty breakfasts, lunches, and dinners, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Get at least one for each family member. My Patriot Supply also sells biomass stoves, off-grid room heaters for when the power goes out, gravity-powered water filters, heirloom seeds, and survival gear that may come in handy soon. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com today. It's time to prepare for what's coming. MyPatriotSupply.com.
G'day, I'm Jamel that works with Dr. Joel Wallach and the GCN team with Youngevity at teamg'day.com. By becoming an associate, you provide income for you and your family on your own hours while working from home. So contact me, Jamel, by filling in the contact box at teamg'day.com and I will get back to you personally and provide all the support you need to get started and build your Youngevity business. Teamg'day.com. Teamg'day.com.
Anytime, any place, anywhere, radio remains the most intimate of all forms of media. At home, at work, in the car, on smartphones. Over 90% of consumers still listen to radio every week. That makes choosing radio as a place to advertise your business one of the best decisions you can make. Email advertise@gcnlive.com and partner up with an experienced GCN representative. Advertise@gcnlive.com. Easy, affordable, effective.